Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they did get it absolutely correct. This is Tom Novolis, your host. This week, we are going to be a little bit more local in the idea that we are going to be discussing Ohio Issue 1, the ballot issue that's coming up here in August, like a special election, and it's going to be very interesting as I go through this. And it is applicable across the nation, because as I reviewed this, and I'm going to get into how it came about that I'm doing the program shortly, but as I reviewed this, I look at it once again as Ohio being a test case for all the other states. Not the first time that Ohio has been targeted by left extremists. And I'm going to call it left extremists and extremism as I bring it together for you, especially in the second segment. So those who listen to only the first and the third segment, you're definitely going to have to go to the second segment to catch the some of the specifics on issue one as to who's involved, who's funding it, what those differences are, who the real radicals are. You're going to have to take and understand that. But let me start out with how is it that I decided to make this a specific state issue instead of a lot of the generalized historical anti-federalist views that I take. Well, first off, this is a critical anti-federalist perspective, especially at the state level. What prompted me was a dear brother and friend of mine who asked me some questions in email the other day in respect to issue one. And the primary question that he brought up was, are we kicking the can down the road again? And, you know, what's wrong with the state legislature? And thirdly, he asked a question, where are the churches? Where are those, especially in the Reformed Christian community? Because he goes to a Reformed Baptist church, which doesn't act in the context as one would think a Reformed church would act in relationship to John Knox, even to Calvin, even to any of those from the founding era, our Puritan founders, and worse is the transformation of the congregational churches throughout the Northeast and Ohio and elsewhere across this country. So I answered him because he brought out this idea about, you know, are we kicking the can down the road? What is issue one? And, you know, how is it that why are we even getting there? And my reply to him was, well, yeah, you're on the right track, but we need to talk. So we talked the other night quite extensively and going through all of the various aspects. So a lot of you are wondering, what is issue one in Ohio? What is that you're babbling about there, Tom? What does it mean to the rest of us? Issue one, in essence, and again, we'll get into the details of it in the second segment. Issue one, in essence, is to take and change the initiative process for a constitutional amendment to amend the Ohio Constitution from its simple majority to a supermajority of voters, 60% or more. In addition to that, what it does, instead of requiring signatures only in 44 of the 88 counties, it requires a minimum of signatures, no different than what it was, 10% of former gubernatorial election, in 88 counties versus that within the 44 counties. So it makes it more broad that the people across the state have to have some input and have signatures across the 88 counties. This is, you know, some people are looking at it going, whoa, wait a minute. Does that mean that the people aren't going to have the opportunity to put it initiative for a constitutional amendment on, or with a supermajority? What does that mean? Quite frankly, it is a two-sided coin. It is a something that does seemingly tie the hands of liberty-minded people, but at the same time, it will tie the hands of all the special interest groups that are trying to put into a constitution what they cannot get into legislation. So I want to bring you to a historical perspective in Ohio, and I hope that satisfies you. The references are there for those that are definitely interested in what issue, the specifics of issue one, are in the detail of the language, which I don't need to get into. I think that summary for you is sufficient at this moment. You know, going from a 50% simple majority, 50% plus one, to a supermajority by the people to vote on and approve a constitutional amendment, and to take and have a larger spread of individuals across the state sign on. And we'll get into some of the, like an amendment that I was working on and what that means. But let's go back to what I wanted to on that historical perspective just for a little bit. As many of you know, I was doing a Ohio Constitution class and taking people through, you know, the Ohio Constitution in a way that nobody else does. I mean, my commentaries in there are worth just the entertainment value alone, if not the significance of the what I dug into. When we took on the topic of the how to amend the Constitution in the state of Ohio, from its origin up through the 1851 Constitution, and then the idea that a constitutional convention was called, initially it was set called in 1910, actuated in 1911, finalized in 1912, was the Progressive Era. So what I want to talk about here is the parallels right now from that historical perspective, and I will cover the churches in this as well, and what's going on in that in relationship to our present, our past, as well as now the mental attitudes of the people. And this is all the critical points that were played on in 1910, 1911. So the question that was pondered, and the resource that I have, and you can find it in your documentation at samueladamsreturns.net, was a book written, or I should say a PhD dissertation that was written by a Landon Warren, and he was assistant professor of history and political science at Kenyon College, and he wrote this book on the Ohio Constitutional Convention of 1912, and it's in the Ohio State Archaeological and Historical Quarterly, Volume 61 of January of 1952. So that's the primary resource for what occurred. As a side note, and we'll bring it up later, most likely in the third segment, is that the redistricting amendment that was passed in the state of Ohio, which caused all the problems in redistricting, was put on by socialist, communist, progressives with Obama that caused all the problems here in Ohio. And Ohio, and the reason I'm saying that, Ohio was targeted. Ohio was targeted by that group, and the references and resources are there for you. Eric Holder's group targeted specifically Ohio on the redistricting challenge and got it into our Constitution in Ohio, as well as he pushed it in other states. So too, what we have sitting in front of us is the most evil abortion amendment to a Constitution that there is. It will destroy families. So when my friend was asking the question, will this kick the can? Will issue one kick the can? Or is issue one here on a immediate constitutional amendment a precursor to stopping the abortion constitutional amendment? Becomes a great and interesting discussion. Because that is what people are trying to utilize as the argument for issue one, is to stop outside influence. So let's get back in the last 3 minutes to the 1912. It was outside influences that put into play the progressive movement of the golden age in America into the Ohio Constitution. It was targeted. Ohio was targeted by the progressives in such a manner that it was, the question was, you know, why did we have this? So what created the demand? What was the character of the convention? Was it dominated by extremists of either right or left? A fear expressed by those opposing a call today. Is it the right or left? Is it extremist? What were its objectives and how successful were they in realizing them? What educational value did the people of the state gain? Well, I'll tell you right now, there is no educational value from 1912 to the present because the educational system has destroyed any idea of our historical factors, not only in the United States in general, but here in Ohio in particular. So there was a timetable, and quite frankly, at that time, both Democrats and Republicans endorsed the idea of a constitutional convention. Now, and we'll see as we get into the second segment, that there's a distinctive split between the Republicans and Democrats. And you will see that the Democrats that are for this, and one Republican, Kasich, of course, are for this because they're the radicals. They are, in so many parts, the socialist Marxists and haters of humanity that are against this amendment. So we look at all of the what happened in 1912, and as it will be now, and you can look at it statistically from the polls, people are giving it a perfunctory attention to the question. So what's the definition of perfunctory? Perfunctory is, for those that don't know, is a action or gesture carried out with a minimum of effort or reflection. So I was really delighted when my friend and brother asked me, what is issue one? How do we deal with it? What happened to the legislature? Where are true Christian churches in relationship to issue one? What's going on? So that's what we're going to continue to cover because it's critical, even when we look at what was going on. And what I want to leave you with in this section here that was also from 1912 and today, a most favorable psychological time. The progressive movement was new and it was moving fast and it was for radical advocates for change. What is our psychological people like? What is the psychology of today? Come on back in the next two segments A Samuel Adams Returns. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second segment of Samuel Adams Returns as we delve back into what is Ohio Issue 1, the 60% vote requirement to approve constitutional amendments, which is a measure on the ballot coming up here in August. We are going to get into the little bit more details in the third segment as to what about kicking the can down the road, where's the legislature, and most importantly, where is the church, the body of Christ, the individual Christian within the context of their conscience biblically identified, and what does that mean, let alone where are the congregations in relationship to that. But first off, let's go ahead, and as I mentioned in the last opening segment, is that the changes that in the battles that are going on here are who is involved. And from the 1912 convention, which has some differences, I wanted to first finish off or go back and revisit was the idea of the psychological time. I kind of stuttered at the end of the program because I was trying to figure out how to look at that from a psychological makeup of the people. We have so many that their psychology and their thought processes are based on leftism due to the educational system, especially the young voters, the young people. They have no idea that moral context, moral legislation happens all the time. If somebody tells you you cannot legislate morality, they are sons and daughters of the devil. They are absolute deceivers. Why is that, Tom? Because morality is legislated every time it goes into passage. Our founders, anybody that has dealt with law really understands that. The question will always be, whose morality? What morality? That is the real question when it comes to law and legislating morality. It's always going to be moral. It has to, because God Almighty is a moral lawgiver, and the antithesis of that is to be immoral. Simple. So that's the question, is where is the morality of our society when it comes to making these decisions on constitutions which are covenantal? And that I'll get into in the last segment because people don't understand covenant. But unlike 1912, where we had both Republicans and Democrats wanting to have that convention because they had selfish ideas and intentions, you had the urban capitalists then led by the Ohio State Board of Commerce wanted to rewrite the taxation article in order to abolish the rule of taxing all property, tangible, intangible, at a uniform rate and permit classifications. Marx ended up writing about that, even though Marx... Oh, wait a minute. When did Marx write? 1800s. So when you had classifications of taxation, graduated taxation, that was Marxist. But that's okay because the capitalist wanted it. Then you had the liquor interests were trying to put in a licensing board to try and get ahead of what was going to go on with prohibition. And then you had the progressives. Now, this is the same then as now in so many ways, as you'll hear the arguments and you'll read the arguments in the Ballotpedia references. They demanded all of the social progress that accumulated over the past decades at that time, from the mid-1800s to the early 1900s, and it varied from reforms in municipal home rule, direct primaries, the initiative and referendum process, equal suffrage, improvements in court system and procedures and legal protection for workers. All of that sounds interesting, right? Not when it comes from a socialist progressive perspective. Then you had key players, and we got to talk about the key players then and now. Henry George, he was a progressive. There's a lot of information I have on him. Henry Demarest Lloyd, a key progressive, epitomized partisan social reform in the late 19th century. Then the Ohio reformers, these were all progressives. Tom L. Johnson, Cleveland mayor, best known as a key progressive. Peter Witt, Frederick Howe, Herbert Bigelow, a big player, and then Brand Whitlock, and then the Toledo Crusader, Samuel Milton Jones. Then you had the muckrakers, the media, and all of these people that were there. You had also at that time performers. Boy. So let's jump ahead in these last 8-9 minutes. And go over to now, Ballotpedia. And I want you to go through that reference and what it talks about. The yes vote is supporting the requirement of a supermajority. That's very, very critical to understand. The initiative petitions proposing constitutional amendments, so it goes back to what the progressives put in and how to change the Constitution. You got to remember, the Ohio Constitution is changed for the benefit of taxation, because we would not have all of the taxes, especially the road taxes, the gas taxes, the school taxes, the monsters of the universities as these independent behemoth organizations stealing taxpayer money without constitutional amendments that were put in by the progressives and then by you, who were alive in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, who approved constitutional amendments to increase the taxes for the good of the people. You were fooled. You were deceived. So here it goes on to say that it makes that change that you have at least 5% of the electors in each of the 88 counties rather than 44 counties, but you still have the required signatures from 10% of the electors that had voted in the previous gubernatorial election. And then it removes a 10-day period for petitioners to gather signatures if it's the insufficient numbers were filed. They can go back and get the rest of those signatures. The no vote is opposing this. When you take and you start looking at who the others were, where other states, when you look at it from out of 49 states, that Delaware does not require voters to approve a constitutional amendment. 38 states have a simple majority of 50 plus one to approve a proposed constitutional amendment. 11 other states have a variety from anywhere from the supermajority of 60 to the likes of Colorado, where they have a supermajority of 55%. So when you get down into the Ballotpedia here on who argues for, you'll see that it is two key Republicans, a state senator, Robert McCauley, and a state representative, Brian Stewart, who are arguing for it. And their argument is interesting in that what they say is quite simple, that they want the constitutional amendment to stop special interest groups. Now, we've seen a lot of that. We saw the special interest groups in 1912. That's the parallel on what happened during that convention. It was the special interest groups that changed the Ohio Constitution. Now, we have seen over and over again special interest groups. And the one in particular is what happened in our process of redistricting. That was Eric Holder and Obama targeted, as I said before, targeted Ohio. And, you know, Ohio, it's not a red state. It's purple at best. So when you look at that in the Ballotpedia arguments, then you look at each of those representatives opposed. You have a state senator, Paula Hicks, out of Hudson, Ohio. She is a communist. You have Vernon Sykes, is a leftist socialist. You have Devontis Jarrell. That person is another socialist communist. You have Bride Rose Sweeney, another communist. And Danny Isakon, another socialist communist. And then when you take and you look at all that they have to say, and you got to get into these people's backgrounds. So what we have, again, is more than progressivism. You have the Marxist social communists, and they use the same rhetoric of protecting rights, of protecting people. They use that same rhetoric that was used in 1911 and 1912. All right, let's get down to the real issues. Where is the support? So look again, as I talked about back in that original 1910-12 period for the Ohio Constitutional Convention, let's look at the supporters, the people involved. So on the supporter side, the officials are Governor DeWine, you have State Senator Matt Huffman, State Senator McCauley, you have Representative Stevens, and Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Some people are upset about it on a politicized component just because DeWine and LaRose are for it. Well, think harder. Now here's the interesting organizations. National Federation of Independent Businesses. That means us, small business people. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce, which is, whoa, how are they involved? But that's a good thing. The Ohio Farm Bureau, huge. We have to use what they have to say. Ohio Hotel and Lodging Association, Ohio Pork Council, the Ohio Restaurant Association, and the Ohio Right to Life. So when we start looking at then the arguments and then into the official argument, I think that that's critical that you go read. You need to go read these on your own out of Ballotpedia. The link is there at samueladamsreturns.net. Now here's the opposition. The opposition is State Allison Russo, a Democrat, obviously, State Representative Anita Somany, State Rep Bride Rose Sweeney. And as I said, they're all leftists. Now here's the former officials, the top communist in Ohio, one of the top ones in the United States, former Attorney General Richard Caudray, top. Former Attorney General Lee Fisher, another one. Here is a socialist, I will call fascist, Republican, former Governor John Kasich. He hates what American constitutionalism and what a republic is. Former Governor Ted Strickland and former Governor Bob Taft. They're all against this amendment. Political parties on the are against it. The Libertarian Party of Ohio and the Working Families Party. That is a registered communist party. Unions are against it. Ohio AFL-CIO. Of course, the Education Association and the Federation of Teachers, Ohio Federation. And worse is the Ohio auto workers are against it. As I always said, these unions have been taken over. Other organizations are ACLU, Children Defense Fund, League of Women Voters, Ohio Women's Alliance Action Fund, Planned Parenthood, and the Sierra Club. These leftist organizations are against it because they are key promoters of evil agendas and ideologies. And they want a simple majority so that they confuse the people, and they have the money. to make the changes. Come on back for the third segment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this last segment of Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists had it correct. As we left off in the last segment, we were talking about the who's who supporting or against this issue one constitutional amendment in the state of Ohio. One of the aspects that I want to make clear, and the critical component of it, is that if this passes in August, it will go into effect immediately. Now, people wonder, you know, why? What's the issue on that? The issue on that is that they want it to go into effect immediately because, as I mentioned before, the radical left has a extreme abortion initiative as a constitutional amendment. And there's an article there, I'm using it out of Breitbart, that you need to go read on what's going on with all of that. Now, in my conversations with my friend the other day, what was interesting is that the radical groups who spent money, this was not a grassroots signature gathering effort. And this is the whole issue and why some people are that were attorney friends of mine and other colleagues in that were somewhat against, or some are still not sure of why we should be doing issue one in August, was because then where is it that the people would have the ability to get a constitutional amendment in place? But when we look at it, is that it is now the money interests are the only ones that are going to get constitutional amendments moving forward. If you remember, during the COVID, I worked on putting together a constitutional amendment for medical freedom in Ohio. Very simple amendment is what we were able to drive it to. Another group took that issue over, and as I predicted, those in my committee that were actually doing the initial thrust on that said, is you got to have at least $5+ million to move an initiative forward, because grassroots alone cannot garner the signatures. And that was also brought out by another friend and colleague who was able to get a constitutional amendment put in place in our Bill of Rights on liberty during the Obamacare nonsense. And that's what they said. It took major financial backing to buy signatures. So let's be clear on it, is that what this leftist organizations did, and the funding isn't laid out yet in Ballotpedia, how that all has worked, because they show what groups fund the different aspects. That won't be until the end of the election on issue one. The fact that this group already had submitted the other day 700,000 signatures. Let me say that again. 700,000 signatures. They only need 413,446 signatures have to be valid. And that's over right now within the context of the 44 counties. But the question is, from a strategic perspective, did these paid signature people, did these leftist groups understand ahead of time, as issue one was coming forward, that it was going to need to have signatures in 5% of the registered voters in 88 counties, 700,000 signatures could have sufficient signatures regardless of issue one passing. Now, the strategic hope is that issue one will pass and it will go into effect immediately, such that then strategically the hope is that these signatures that were put in 700,000 played under the old rules of the 50% and the 44 counties. 44 counties. For those on radio, I held up two hands with fours. Hey, got to have a little fun in the depth of this. But folks, the evil people have the funding. As I have said before, it takes $5 to $10 million to get a constitutional amendment passed in today's environment. Media ads, people going out, paid people to go out and get signatures. Fortunately, issue one came out of the legislature. So to go on to my friend's question, where is the legislature in respect to this? Thankfully, issue one came out of the legislature. Also, where's the legislature on all of the issues of abortion and all these other social issues here in Ohio? I think there's a good number of legislators that are against abortion. We've seen the heartbeat bill. We've seen a number of very morally in that direction of the sovereignty of God's moral values in legislation. But we have a wishy-washy Speaker of the House. Not sure the Senate is highly politicized. We have a governor that is halfway in between any moral truth and position, unless it's politically expedient for him. So where's the legislature? The legislature, if they pass more strict abortion laws, would find themselves in court. So this becomes part of the conundrum for every legislature. That's why Ohio is a target. Again, Ohio is a target, and it is a test case. So issue one is part of that strategic component of the test case of Ohio, no different than it was with Eric Holder and Obama in relationship to getting what? The whole issue on the redistricting. So the conundrum of the redistricting, and then the latest passage of the state of the federal Supreme Court in reference to South Carolina and Alabama on redistricting, is the conundrum on what is constitutional voting and elections and what does it mean to redistrict. But not to belabor that, but to stay on issue one and this abortion amendment, go to the references and read on that abortion amendment. The abortion amendment has language in such a structure that it will allow for mutilization of children without parental consent. And it'll be like California and other places that if you try and influence a child not to have abortions, to not be mutilated with these satanic transition insanities, evil, you're the one that'll be prosecuted. So that's all weaved into that language of that abortion amendment in such a deceptive manner that it is very interesting and important then to look at how will issue one, the 60% move, play out as a stopgap, strategic stopgap that the legislature has taken and put in place. But then the question is, on the other strategic side, which we don't know, is did those leftists paid for signature takers get 5% of 88 counties so that they're already ahead of what issue one is trying to accomplish? We don't know. But at this point, the simple answer is the legislature did take action by bringing issue one forward to the people to stop not only the abortion issue, but what's going on with drugs in Ohio, what's going on with all these other leftists, or some libertarians will call them libertarianism for Ohio, all of the social reforms, all of the reforms that are modernized but are exponential in evil to the liberties and morality of a free people that were in 1910 through 12. That is what issue one is attempting to put the brakes on, so that it's not easy. The argument that it takes away from we the people, I'm sorry, in today's environment, we the people do not have a chance in a steel manufacturing furnace because we can't raise the money. But the evil groups have more money to spend. So that's the argument there on issue one. Where are the churches? People ask. My friend asks, where are they? And the other side goes to, with that, where is the legislature? I want to take you back to one of the areas in these last 3 minutes and components, again, from the book on the pastors of New England, what was happening in the churches of New England at the time. And in that was very important was that the writings and everything that was happening, although there were a lot of different denominations that were starting to make some moves, you remember that the Congregationalists were more Puritans. We had some Presbyterians there, a few Baptists there. So you had, again, this very few Catholics, but you had these denominational contentions, quite frankly, that were coming about. And then by time you got into the mid-1700s, you had Unitarianism and Universalism that was creeping in, and there were a lot of different definitions that were happening. But for the most part, in the major denominations, what is there that we don't see today is, what does it mean for the sovereignty of Christ in all things, every aspect of life? What is it that he is the King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the absolute sovereign of everything in life, including the political? We don't hear that preached in all of the denominations. In fact, many of the major denominations have gone away from that understanding of sovereignty of Christ across the whole scripture, Old Testament at all. So what we have, therefore, especially in a lot of the independent churches, that they don't teach, they don't understand, they don't understand the history, they do not understand what I mentioned earlier in this last minute is covenant, and what covenant means in constitutionalism. Now that is discussed very, very clearly here in this book on the New England clergy. They understood covenant and constitutionalism across the denominations, and they could agree on that. We don't have agreement anymore on that. So therefore, when a Christian gets elected to office or appointed, they have no understanding of covenant relationship. They have lose, in many cases, understanding of what it means to bow to the sovereignty of Christ in all things. Therefore, we end up with moral legislation that is immoral. come on back next week when Sam Adams returns and those anti-federalists did get it correct.